the statement that if you change the tax one more time, we'll leave the state. And that's for you as legislators to decide whether or not that is true and that is going to occur. It wasn't until about 1986 that I felt that the state of Alaska had finally reached their fair share of the legislation. And again, when Senator Dankworth was chairman of the Finance Committee, it was changed the last time. We lowered the tax somewhat overall, but we increased it for some other areas. I voted for the legislation, even though it brought the tax down, not substantially, but somewhat from the previous taxes that the industry had been paying. I felt that the state of Alaska had been receiving, at this point in time, approximately one-third of the royalty, of the interest, of the resource from the oil and gas industry. And I felt that the state of Alaska and its people deserved and should have that share of the resource. Now, the question arises as to what has occurred since then. The Department of Law and the Department of Revenue have been attempting to collect these taxes, a variety of different taxes from the oil industry. At the same time that they were collecting, there have been settlements of $1.6 billion approximately, $1.3 billion, that there have been settlements with the oil industry on taxes that they contested and settled out of court. During the process that we were settling these cases, the state of Alaska realized that the amount of the valuation that the oil industry was saying that they had on our oil was a lot more than they were telling the state. And as a result of this, there became reassessments that had to occur during that period of time. Now, based on a technicality, it's my feeling, again, as former Representative Hugh Malone has said, that the oil industry is attempting to escape their liability. I just want to make this statement. As a former legislator, I never felt that any of the money, whether it was at 1% when I started or 33% when I left the legislature, belonged to me as an individual. The taxes that were collected belonged to the people of this state. And as a legislator, I had the responsibility to ensure that to the maximum extent possible, the people of the state received their fair share. And I feel that you as legislators have that responsibility now to make sure that the people of the state receive their fair share. Thank you.
Okay. My name is Arco.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is George Findling. I'm the Manager of Government and Public Relations for ARCO Alaska. To summarize, we oppose Senate Bill 185. While the difficulties in this bill have been well given in the AOGA testimony, I want to direct my concerns today to the very troublesome prospective impacts this legislation will have. This bill casts an ominous shadow over the future because clearly it will introduce further future tax uncertainty and drive even more investment dollars from Alaska. Most Alaskans agree that oil and gas development is and will be the economic lifeblood of this state. Therefore, we think that it's in the state's interest to encourage this activity to attract investment back to Alaska. Concerning 185, ARCO has a unique position whose interests are as a future investor in Alaska. We underpin this position with a long history of commitment to the state, but we do have a broad range of investment opportunities both in Alaska and other locations. Alaskan investments must compete with these other opportunities for scarce capital. If this bill passes, as written, our industry will have to add a greater degree of tax uncertainty into already tough investment decisions for Alaska. The result will be less investment and less production than otherwise. To this date, the state has been unable or unwilling to tell its major taxpayers what the correct tax is, fully and finally, when it's due. Worse, with SB 185, the state wants to enshrine a practice of increasing tax owed at every turn in a process in which we don't have a fair standing. This bill is not intended to collect the correct amount of tax. Rather, it is designed to allow the Department of Revenue to have unlimited time to invent constantly changing schemes to collect more tax than the legislature ever intended. This bill feels like punishment. Using a football analogy, it's like piling on. That's because if a taxpayer appeals the assessment, the state can use a process already biased against taxpayers to add even more to the tax bill. And this is quite different from creating incentives for taxpayers to pay the correct tax. To summarize, we believe that the state can choose a considered approach for the future in which the value of tax certainty is seen and investment by our industry is encouraged. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to make these comments.
Questions?
ARCO has a very good history in paying their bills. I've stated that some companies tap Cochrane Lion and pat us on the head, but ARCO is paid up. You do involve yourself politically pretty heavily at times. That's not what we're here for. What about merely legislation that suggests that we extend the statute of limitations for the periods that we are now finding contest? We're not talking about the future. Get your act together on both sides, but extend the statute of limitations for presently, in our mind, or many of our minds, overdue and past due taxes.
Well, as I stated before, we support the AOGA testimony, and that includes both the fact that SB 185 has a retroactive clause to it, and we don't like that retroactivity part. Now, I think, as you mentioned, we are, call it paid up, but still, we do oppose the retroactive part of this legislation.
Not that you're all going to hang together, you're going to hang apart. Thank you.
Yes.
Senator Lincoln.
I would like to ask you, too, from the testimony that AOGA gave previously and hearing what BP had to say on why perhaps ARCO chose the route of the informal conference rather than a formal hearing.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lincoln, I'm not sure on the facts of that matter whether all taxpayers have chosen informal conferences. And I think that's something that probably needs to be looked back into.
Because the information I've got is all.
I understand that. Yeah, and I'm not sure that that's accurate.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thanks. George, as long as you have your testimony written out, could you leave a comment?
Yeah, you bet.
Okay, and Norma Calvert with Marathon. Thank you for being so patient.
My name is Norma Calvert, and I'm here today representing Marathon Oil Company. We appreciate the opportunity to comment on SB 185. Marathon is opposed to Senate Bill 185 because we feel it is bad legislation both for the state of Alaska and for the taxpayers. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that a statute of limitations is an almost indispensable element of fairness, as well as a practical administration of tax policy. It is designed to promote justice by preventing surprises through the revival of claims that have been allowed to slumber until evidence has been lost, memories have faded, and witnesses have disappeared. It is ill-advised to have a tax system under which there would never come a day of final settlement, and which require both the taxpayer and the government to stand ready forever and a day to produce the vouchers, prove the events, and recall details of all that goes into a tax appeal. Section 2 of Senate Bill 185 has the potential to require the taxpayer to stand ready forever and a day. It permits the Department of Revenue to increase or decrease the amount of tax due by amending an assessment at any time during the administrative consideration of the taxpayer's grievance on an assessment or a claim for credit or refund of a tax. This rule, if adopted, would differ from the rules of most other states' tax administration. The amendment would render meaningless the well-established 3-year assessment period provided for in AS 4305-260A. If the department believes that a 3-year period of time is too limited to complete its assessments, it can always ask for an extension from the taxpayer, and I think you will find historically those extensions have been given. If this amendment is enacted into law, the department would have an indefinite amount of time to complete its assessment. It would be free to delay administrative proceedings in order to amend an assessment as often as it pleases. If, for example, it were expecting a favorable judicial decision on a particular issue and could change an assessment at will, there would be powerful motivation to extend the administrative process. The lack of finality to an assessment is unfair and seriously hinders the taxpayer's ability to defend against it. In fact, under the proposed statute, the department could amend an assessment just as a formal hearing was about to end, forcing the taxpayer to start its defense all over again. The purpose behind the statute of limitations is to introduce a measure of finality into the assessment process. The production tax process starts with payment of taxes by the industry on a monthly basis. Thereafter, the Department of Revenue reviews these payments and may issue an assessment for additional taxes that they believe are due. An assessment is a serious matter. It is the formal recording of a taxpayer's alleged additional liability. Assessments of a tax have fundamental significance in the Alaskan tax system in two ways. First, an assessment establishes a taxpayer's liability for the amount of any alleged additional tax due, and therefore the department's entitlement to collect and retain an amount as a tax. Until an assessment is made, the department cannot collect a tax administratively because the collection provisions of Section 4305-270 depend on the making of a demand for payment, which in turn assumes the making of an assessment. Even after collection, the department cannot retain an amount as a tax unless an assessment is made timely. Any tax paid and collected after an untimely assessment is refundable. Second, and perhaps more importantly, the assessment of tax is an administrative act that divides the examination and administrative settlement procedures from collection procedures, and ultimately the judicial review of the administrative process. Significant rights and obligations arise from an assessment. The department, in exercising its right to make an assessment, should be confident enough to then stand by it. An assessment, when made, should be final, thus permitting the taxpayer to pay or challenge it with some degree of confidence that the rules will not be changed in midstream. As for Section 3 of the Act, which extends the period of limitations during which the tax may be collected by levy or by proceedings in court to 6 years after a final administrative or judicial resolution, Marathon believes it is unreasonable, considering that other states and federal governments suspend the statute in similar situations. For example, in Texas, which in the past has been described by former members of the administration as the leading oil producing state in the Union, the statute of limitations on levy is suspended where the assessment is challenged in court. The federal system is similar. The running of the statute for collection by levy is suspended until 60 days after the decision of the tax court becomes final. The commissioner then is entitled to use the 60-day period together with any unexpired portion of the statute of limitations remaining at the time it became suspended. Alaska, in extending the period for 6 years after the final administrative or judicial proceeding, is going beyond what is considered reasonable in other jurisdictions. In closing, Marathon Oil respectfully requests that the members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee reject Senate Bill 185.
Any questions?
Sure. About why we go the informal, I am not in a position, I've not been involved with our process ourselves, and so I really couldn't answer that for ourselves.
Now, Molyneux. Did I pronounce that correctly, Don?
Yeah, the first one was Molyneux. I believe you pronounced it Molyneux. That's an A in the name. And mine's an English pronunciation of a French name, and it's Molyneux. Or in France, it's Molyneux.
What is it in Alaska?
Molyneux. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Val Molyneux, and today I'm representing Vico International Inc., and Norcon Inc., a general contractor, and a holding company employing some 3,500 people representing both union and non-union workers. Our major companies are Alaska-based with executives, managers, and employees having homes and families located in all regions of the state of Alaska. VECO International opposes Senate Bill 185. This bill, if passed, would probably result in additional tax and litigation claims on our major oil industry. The industry requires a stable tax climate for long-term development investments in the state of Alaska. Since the major economic limit factor, commonly known as ELF tax, was introduced, various major oil industries have left the state of Alaska. They include Chevron, Amoco, Texaco, and more recently, Conoco. These companies are now investing their time and money in other locations. This has resulted in loss of business and employment opportunities for many Alaskans. An unfavorable tax climate resulting from the passing of Senate Bill 185 will probably result in the remaining major oil companies, Exxon, BP, and ARCO, to invest their exploration and development dollars in more favorable business environments around the world and not in Alaska. Should these dollars be lost to other locations, Alaskan oil field service companies and their suppliers, vendors, and associated families would be without employment opportunities. If this tax is enacted, the flow of oil through the pipeline would reduce accordingly, and the state of Alaska would have less dollars to operate with. It is my understanding that 80 to 85% of the state's Alaska's revenues are generated from the taxes on the oil flowing through the Alaska pipeline. The flow peaked in 1988 in excess of 2 million barrels per day. Today's output is approximately 1.6 million barrels a day, some 400 to 500 million barrels per day less. This is a significant drop in revenues to the state of Alaska. In summary, the passing of Senate Bill 185 would most likely result in the loss of jobs for Alaskans and a reduction in revenues to the state of Alaska. Once again, thank you for giving me the opportunity of addressing this committee.
I won't try to pronounce your name. In your testimony, you allude that the ELF tax was the reason for these companies to leave. Is that the sole reason that these companies left Alaska?
I obviously can't answer that question because I'm not associated directly with any of the decisions that each of these oil companies made. But at the time ELF was on the table, I was president of the Alaska Support Industry Alliance, and I had communications with many of the oil industries and the oil field service industries at that time. And my opinion was, based on common knowledge, general knowledge from many of these people in the state of Alaska, was that if in fact that ELF task was passed, you would see a change in oil exploration in the state of Alaska.
By these companies?
By people that work for those companies, and some people that also work for the companies directly. If you're going to ask me the specific names, I'm sorry, I probably will not be able to give you that answer. It's some while ago.
Further questions? Thank you, Val. Becky, are you still online in Anchorage? Is Anchorage still online?
Yes, here we go.
Go ahead, Becky.
Okay, thank you. I'll talk fast. I'm the Executive Director of the Resource Development Council, and I thank you for the opportunity to comment on SB 185. REC is a proponent of stable tax policy, and we're strongly opposed to SB 185. Every industry ought to be concerned with this attempt at reaching into the past to settle present budget problems. Most groups aren't here today to testify because it's perceived as just an oil industry problem. But I can assure you, and the Native corporations that have testified have proven that it affects at least the most fundamental of Alaska organizations. If this bill extended to the agriculture sector or the forest products industry, the fishing industry, or even the elusive so-called ecotourism providers, you'd see a huge crowd of dissenting constituents ready to do battle with each of you over this issue. We're strongly opposed to SB 185. We think it's bad policy for the following reasons. It's a disincentive for timely assessment. If 3 years to assess and 6 years to just initiate collection is not enough time, then we believe the Department of Revenue needs to rethink its priorities and perhaps hire additional auditors. There's probably some in my group that would say that the auditors should be working at least 40 hours a week as well. SB 5185 as bad because it rewards and it codifies bad behavior. Again, if state employees cannot get their most obvious and important work done in 9 years, such as tax assessing, auditing, and collections, then we believe the legislature is sending the wrong message to them. Maybe an internal audit of work priorities would be a better place to start than changing rules to fit that kind of behavior. We believe SB 185 will discourage investment for Alaska. As any business person can tell you, uncertainty weighs heavily in investment decisions. It's hard enough to keep research industries in Alaska with the present obstacles, and of course the future is always uncertain. But changing the past is something no one can plan for, much less anticipate. This long reach into the past introduces the mother of all uncertainty to tax assessment, and should scare anyone who has ever done business in Alaska, so they should be next. SB 185 is unfair. It's particularly unfair because it singled out only one industry to apply retroactive tax decisions to. REC also believes SB 185 is unnecessary. And you heard, in practice, taxpayers have been very willing to voluntarily extend the assessment deadline at the request of the state. SB 185 is definitely a short-sighted attempt to retroactively beef up the present while shortchanging the future of resource investment in Alaska. It is a revisionist stick with no carrot, and it should send chills to those who are here today, and it also sends a very bad signal to those who are trying to get here to come in for the future. We also support the testimony of Siri, Koniag, Aoga, and the oil industry individuals that testified today and before. The legislature, we believe, should send a signal to the Department of Revenue that assessing and collecting taxes in a timely manner is critical to the state budget. 9 years is a long enough time. In fact, we could be through the terms of two governors and into a third in that same amount of time. Even Attorney General Battelle today defined longstanding as 10 years. So we think this is enough time. We think that state employees need to do their jobs in that amount of time and not try to change the rules. In conclusion, REC recommends strongly against this retroactive tax bill. Although it is an understandable attempt to squeeze more blood from stone in these days of budget deficits and declining production, there really is only so much you can squeeze from the past. The legislature would do far better trying to encourage the future of its industry and its people. Thank you very much for the time.
Thanks, Becky. Any questions? Okay, then the last person we'll hear from today is John Ringstad with BP. Sooner you're done, the sooner we're out of here.
Something tells me that this is the time to be last and least.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Ringstad, and I'm testifying on behalf of BP. Last year, when the bill was before Senate Judiciary, Paul Sullivan of Exxon gave testimony urging the committee to reject it. I recommend his testimony to anybody wanting to get a complete understanding of this bill. In addition, BP fully endorses the comments that have already been presented on behalf of AOGA. Let me give you an example of what would be perfectly plausible if SB 185 becomes law. Within 3 years of filing your tax return, the audit division decides you made a mistake or misinterpreted some of the regulations. You get an assessment and a demand for payment. Say you owe another $100. At that point, you have three choices. You either pay the $100 and forget about it, or you pay the $100 and ask for a refund, or you say you're not going to pay it and you protest it and you ask for a conference with the department. Say you decide you want to protest it rather than pay it. You file your protest and you schedule a conference with the department. Under the present law, if the three-year period for the assessment is passed, the department is bound by that assessment. They can't. They can only ask for the $100. They can't go beyond that. If this bill passes, the department will be free to continually increase the amount of the claim. Additionally, you still have the burden of trying to prove each one of those wrong. You may think this is not a big deal. If the auditors do a fair job determining the correct amount of tax, it is unlikely that the taxpayers will experience upward spirals of new assessments after the protests are filed. Well, I can tell you, the upward spirals of new assessments is exactly what BP has been experiencing. As for the practices of the auditors, I would encourage you to review the testimony given before budget and audit on January 21st. Passage of SB 185 will mean that the only way a taxpayer to gain closure on a tax obligation will be to pay whatever the auditors determine in the first assessment. Otherwise, there is a prospect of a second or maybe eighth assessment. So you prepare the best you can. You hope for the best. You think seriously about paying for the first assessment, even though you know it's more than you probably owe. A different but equally troubling aspect of 185 is that it seriously interferes with the state's judicial process. The state lost its argument before the Superior Court in this issue. The Supreme Court is scheduled to hear it next month. The administration is asking the legislature to pass a bill clarifying the original legislation before the Supreme Court reviews the case. In effect, you're being asked to tell the Superior Court that the statute it interpreted was a phony, and this bill is really the authentic legislation. That's not something I would feel it's real comfortable trying to do. I think you should be aware that 185 means more litigation, not less. Despite some of the testimony that's been given in the past, the unconstitutional soundness of this issue, this legislation, is far from certain. Taxpayers are sure they're going to challenge it. Since 77, I guess it was, the state has spent over $176 million on lawyers and experts litigating oil and gas issues. I hate to think about how much the oil companies have spent. Before the state embarks on another round of this kind of legal battle, we suggest that the committee take independent advice about the constitutionality of this. Finally, I would like to say that for some time, we at BP have been saying that tax clarity is something we need to successfully secure future investment dollars for our North Slope fields in a world fiercely competing for capital dollars. It is hard to think of anything that would have been more contrary to that clarity than SB 185. This bill will make closure of prior claims more difficult than ever. Instead of heading in the right direction, all of us would be headed in the wrong direction. This concludes my testimony. I again say thank you for the opportunity.
Could you leave a written remark for this?
Yes.
Do we have any questions?
Not a question.
Okay, I've got one question. Bruce, I have trouble with because where is finality to these cases that drag on and on and on? I mean, you know, at some point in time, do the courts say, okay, you know, Marathon, you owe us money, or Texaco, or whatever, at what point does all this end and they have to pay something?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Chairman, finality is first reached when the taxpayer requests a formal hearing. A hearing officer is assigned, and the process is the convening of a pre-hearing conference, which sets a series of deadlines, both for discovery, identification of witness lists and the like, and ultimately the scheduling of a hearing. Once the hearing is underway, the parties are obviously put on evidence. The hearing officer then issues the conclusion of the hearing, what is called a recommended decision. And that decision then is presented to the Commissioner of Revenue, who has the power to either accept it, reject it, or modify it. Once it's signed, that is a final decision which is appealable and reviewable in the courts of the state. It goes first. That's correct. And interest is always obviously accruing during that stage. They have a right to appeal first to the Superior Court as an appellate court, and second to the Alaska Supreme Court, and to the extent that constitutional issues are raised, there is the right to seek review by the U.S. Supreme Court, though the Supreme Court has that as a matter of discretion. Of course, that has happened in the past and happened specifically on the challenge to the separate accounting statute itself initiated in the Superior Court.
There's no agreement reached along the way, and it goes through the court system. But where do you get a check when the Supreme Court says you owe this amount of money?
When any court issues a final order which is not further appealed, that's correct.
Have we reached that point in any of these cases? Have we ever had that kind of a final order in a court in the state of Alaska?
The most recent example that comes to mind in terms of a determination on a specific issue, frankly, was within the last several months, the Supreme Court's decision involving ARCO and deciding two specific issues. One is whether the state had a right to seek value over ceiling during price control. The court said yes in a 3-2 decision. And the second issue was whether this taxpayer was entitled to deductions on interest expenses dealing with pipeline. And the Supreme Court said the Department of Revenue was wrong. They were deductible.
What I'm trying to get at, we're in a situation where, with a couple of the companies, the state is trying to settle. They say they're trying to settle, and the state says they're trying to settle. There's nothing being settled. Can it never be settled? Or is there something that's going to force settlement somewhere down the road?
I think this bill forces settlement. I think ultimately, if this bill doesn't pass, settlement will ultimately come in the form of a decision by the Alaska Supreme Court. In the meantime, time will pass by. Interest will be accruing, substantial interest, I think almost to the point where it becomes very difficult for a company to be able to settle. And obviously the missed opportunity for the state to be able to.
What was the interest rate a couple of years ago?
My recollection is in 1990, yes.
So since that point in time, the interest rate is a great deal higher than.
That's right. It's basically, I think, been a driving force in the efforts in this administration to settle. I think it's had that incentive.
There we go.
I'm curious about the in the settlements that have been made, the $1.3 billion, is there a document, a kind of a long written settlement agreement, or is it kind of more along the lines of a deal that says, okay, X million dollars is the deal? And or does it go on and actually spell out a lot of the items which were in dispute, how they were resolved, and so on?
The documents generally do not, Mr. Chairman, identify issue-by-issue resolution, but what it does indicate closure on the tax years and the tax type in dispute, also ultimately allocates both between interest and principal year-by-year. So there has to be an allocation, and that kind of backup is there. Obviously, there's also extensive backup in terms of the negotiations themselves, in terms of state positions. They obviously aren't the records of the companies in that respect, but there is a trail in that respect.
Is interest negotiable?
It is not. What
principle
is obviously negotiable, and that's really when we negotiate, we focus on the issues in dispute that dictate what the principle is. And it's our position that any settlement, and we'll focus on principle, the interest follows from that.
Just to follow up, something in your answer, you said there is an indication of closure. I can't remember the exact phrase you used. Does that mean that basically, as far as the state is concerned, that issue or that year, I guess, either cannot be opened up again?
That's correct. Mr. Chairman, that's correct, with one exception, and it's one that is standard in all tax regimes, and that is if there is a subsequent showing that there's been fraud. And the second aspect that comes up occasionally is a reservation if the IRS is maintaining an audit and later determines that there should be an adjustment where our tax regime is tied. It really doesn't apply to the severance or production taxes, but it does, or the separate accounting, but would in the modified apportionment. Where there's an adjustment at the federal level, there could be a corresponding state adjustment.
Just for the record, the state isn't alleging that there's fraud involved in any of these cases now that we're trying to settle, correct?
That's correct.
Senator Sharp.
Thank you. Are disputes that's been filed and on the court docket or record waiting resolution, scheduling, are they subject to termination by statute of limitations once they're filed?
Mr. Chairman, the process that we have is that the litigation takes place at the commissioner level. It's like there are administrative law judges who are making the decisions. And so the determination about tax and tax liability is made first there. And we're really not disputing, I don't think the industry or the state is disputing, once the decision is made that you have a statute of limitations issue that arises going through the court system, except with respect to the issue of collections. And again, AOGA, Mr. Householder testified, and I think a representative of Marathon today, taken the position, and I made reference to the Texas statute, which says it tolls. The statute of limitations on collections tolls while this matter is going through the appellate process. That has not been the uniform industry position, and that's part of the reason we've sought the change, although we certainly concur in the view that our view is that the collections statute of limitations does indeed toll while the matter is going through the appellate process.
I was getting at, once it's been, the documentation has been presented to, what do you say,
An administrative law judge, let's call that.
That's not subject to termination before they come up with a decision. by statute of limitations, does it? Does the clock continue ticking and wipes out the...
The primary focus, Mr. Chairman, I think, is it's hard to answer yes or no to that question. The argument being made by the industry is that the statute is plainly says 3 years. The department must assess within 3 years. The department says, yeah, that's what we do. Where we part ways is 2 years later or 3 years later, the department, we're still in process. We haven't, there's been an informal conference occurring over months, exchanges of information. The Department of Revenue discovers additional information, or there's been a decision in another case which is found applicable to taxpayer A, and the Department of Revenue issues another assessment on that issue.
Lower or higher?
Or different. Now, let's say it's clearly higher in the sense, and the taxpayers are saying, 3 years is 3 years. That's the bar. You're precluded from raising this issue now. And the Department of Revenue says, no, we've satisfied the statute. We issued an assessment within 3 years. We put you on notice that we were going to contest the tax, your tax payment for that year. We believe you have incorrectly paid the tax. And until there's a final hearing or a settlement, but until there's a final hearing, the correct tax that you owe is open. It's up to the, ultimately up to the administrative law judge and the commissioner of revenue to make the determination of what the correct tax is, which means it could go up or down. And in fact, until the completion of the hearing, where everyone is put to the test about what the tax really is, we don't know what the correct tax is, and the department is free to put on whatever evidence, and the taxpayer is prepared to put on, and is has the right to put on whatever evidence to show what the correct tax amount is. That's the nub of the dispute.
One other question, follow-up on a question earlier. On the interest rate being non-negotiable, or non, I guess that would be correct.
Yes.
Is that a obstacle to settling these cases, or is that a... Does that help?
So, Mr. Chairman, I don't think it has been. I think, and again, all my experiences with the taxpayers, people have dealt with the issues very professionally. There are hard-fought issues. The fact that we reached settlement is a recognition on both sides that there is risk, and that the issues are not clear-cut. But the focus is always on the issues and the principle. I think everyone agrees that the interest should automatically follow from the principal amounts that are in dispute. And so I don't think it has been a hindrance at all not being able to negotiate. It really has.
Yeah, actually, I think that's probably what happened. You know, but
candidly, that does happen. And again, we don't see that as a particular obstacle.
I've had a request from one of the members to get a written opinion on the constitutionality of the retroactive portion of the bill. We'll get that done. We'll have staff look at other oil-producing states as requested by the Attorney General, and we will get a briefing set up by the Department of Revenue so we have some better idea of the complexity and why these cases are taking so long. So, is it really?
I had just two quick questions. How do you answer the question that we've heard today over and over again, that the state would find themselves into more litigation, not less litigation, with this bill?
Mr. Chairman, I assume that reflects the sense that we would litigate once the question of whether the retroactivity provision is constitutional or not. I don't see it as more litigation. I see it as certainly there will be one challenge to that question. I think that I'm confident that the legal advice you get will be to the effect that it is constitutional to retroactively adjust the statute of limitations. But that will be the focus. And I would trust that you would be asking any competent lawyer. The cases say what they do, and we won't be trying to change that outcome.
The second question, final question that I have is that it's puzzling to me, and I didn't hear an answer from any of the oil companies here, as to why they go with an informal conference and the correspondence that we got from your office was that they all go with an informal conference versus the formal hearing, which is more
Mr. Chairman, I think there are probably several reasons, but a couple that occur to me. Once one schedules a formal hearing, you're really talking about a formal trial process, and the costs are significant when you're talking about, let's assume, most of the cases we're talking about are probably $100 million and above. People are willing to invest a lot of money in litigating in terms of expert witnesses, production and the like. I think people will elect to go to an informal conference because there's a lot more flexibility, latitude to exchange views, a lot less formality. And I think, frankly, a lot more. There was a lot more opportunity to engage in early settlement negotiations until the Supreme Court decided that informal conference constituted an administrative proceeding as well. I mean, just in terms of the dynamics, a lot more opportunity for free-flowing exchange without making final commitments at the informal conference stage than going really directly to trial. That's my sense.
But it slows down the process, or that's what I've heard the taxpayers sit here and say, that in a sense that we're going on and litigating this through years and years and years, and they want an early resolve. Doesn't the early resolve, even though it would cost more, come with the formal hearing much more than the informal?
Mr. Chairman, I think there's that possibility. I would say, for the most part, most but not all our settlements have actually occurred at the informal conference stage rather than at formal hearing or after, though some have been after. I can't give you an explanation for why, but I think your observation is probably correct in terms of the speediness.
Okay, further questions?
Was there great similarity between the situations involving the firms that did settle and the ones that haven't settled as far as the changing of assessments and patterns? I would assume it's the same industry, same type of oil coming down, same situation. So some moved into the settlement mode and put it behind them, and some didn't. Is the mechanics real similar to the procedures that happened, or was something different that allowed some of them to move towards settlement and some of them not, in your opinion?
Mr. Chairman, I think one thing that does distinguish certain companies from others is that there are different corporate cultures in terms of trying to reach resolution. And they reflect corporate styles of management, and I think that probably has been as much a driving force for why we have managed to settle with certain companies on virtually all older issues and not reached agreement with others. And each of them is an equally legitimate approach. I don't pass judgment on it. I think it just results in different outcomes.
But the assessment patterns and so forth were very similar?
Yes.
One last question. The old interest rate prior to 1991, it was like 6% simple. Was that?
It was either 6 or 8. That's correct, Mr. Chairman. And
frankly, that's not much incentive to settle if you can make money by waiting, correct?
And that was the point for the change in 1990.
So there's less incentive to settle the older cases, in fact, than there is anything I can do.
Well, the interest rate as of the effective date of your change applies for those older taxes as well, and it I think has had a significant influence to reach earlier rather than later resolution. Although again, I don't want to suggest that any member of the industry has not been receptive or even anxious to try and reach settlement with the state.
Okay, that'll do it. We'll answer some of those questions and come back another time. Thank you.
Thank you.